Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of January 14th, 2011. Are you still waiting around for that dream job instead of taking a job to pay the rent? Well, this week we will explore what is happening to work that has meaning. And January is a popular month for new beginnings, also an infamous one for endings.
Marriage is grand, divorce is 20 grand. If you have a 401k, half of that could be belonging to your spouse, whatever's accumulated during the marriage. You have to protect yourself.
One way to do that? Divorce insurance. And when it comes to investing, how much risk are you willing to take?
Imagine if you went to a dentist and the dentist said, "We want to use the least amount of Novocaine possible. So you tell me what you think the most pain you can take is and we'll go from there."
Yeah, that would not be a good idea at all. We'll explain how that relates to investing. Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money. But first, this could be a big year for consumer protection. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is getting up and running. That's the agency that's supposed to make sure banks and others don't sell us things like exploding mortgages. Meanwhile, we're getting a little more shielding from products that literally could explode or poison us. New legislation kicks in this week, the result of all those toy recalls a few years ago. Sally Herships has more.
What you don't know can hurt you. If you ask Drew Averill, a 39-year-old Brooklyn dad, he'll tell you Averill got hurt really badly while doing something many of us do every morning.
I'm making coffee. I pour the hot water in. I reach for the wooden spoon. I'm stirring it.
He's using a French press, a glass coffee maker. And as he's stirring, the glass breaks and sprays Averill with scalding hot water. He suffered third-degree burns. And if that's not painful enough, Averill didn't have health insurance.
And an overnight stay in the hospital is very expensive. So between the hospital bills, the ambulance bills, and missed work, the injury probably cost me more than $10,000.
Before he bought the coffee maker, Averill hadn't checked any online reviews. But now he says he's a hyper-aware consumer. And that's exactly who the government has in mind. Beginning next week, a new online database will launch, allowing consumers to report and read reports of products with problems.
Safety and health hazards. People can get burned, they can get lacerated, they can have contusions, they can be harmed by projectiles.
That's Alex Phillip. He works for the Consumer Product Safety Commission. He says the database is not a product review site.
I'd personally recommend you go to Consumer Report to find out if something is good.
Instead, he says, the database's job is to identify products with safety or health hazards. The system has existed for decades, but consumers could only find out when a product was recalled. The only way to learn about product complaints was to submit a Freedom of Information Act request. Now, everything is available online. And like before, if there's a significant problem, a product can be recalled. Then the government will ask the manufacturer some questions.
Are you going to be refunding the people's money? Are you going to replace the product? Or are you going to repair the product at no cost?
Phillip says when consumers file complaints, they'll have to certify information as correct, and businesses will get a chance to respond. But like with any online forum, how do you know what to trust? Derek Rucker is a consumer psychologist at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. First, he says, we need to understand negative behavior is more motivating than positive.
You're much more likely to tell someone that you didn't like a movie than you liked the movie.
So if you don't like a product, you're more likely to say so, which can make it tough to evaluate online reviews because, Rucker says, we're also more influenced by negative feedback than positive.
As soon as I see something negative related to it, that's a problem.
One bad comment can trump a lot of good ones. And people whose opinions fall in the middle are even less likely to share. So Rucker's advice is wait until there's enough feedback to tell if the bad reviews or good ones are accurate. As for Drew Averill, the Brooklyn coffee drinker, he bought a new French press made out of metal. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
And the website Sally's talking about is saferproducts.gov. The database won't be available till March, but as of a week from Monday, you can start filing product complaints. Get a job doing what you love, and you'll never work a day in your life. That is a tough sell, even in a good economy, much less when unemployment hovers near 10%. And when job openings are scarce, it might be tempting to apply for anything and everything in sight. just for the paycheck. But Marketplace's Eve Tro reports a better approach might be to keep your high standards in place.
Around 10 a.m. on a Monday morning, Dali Colorado goes for her second round of coffee.
This will bubble and pop.
She's been up a few hours, seen her husband off to his job, straightened up the house. When the stovetop coffee maker goes off again, it's time to work. Meaning look for work. Colorado's been unemployed about 7 months. She feeds her dog, a rescued boxer named Lizzie, and heads for the computer.
It's her least favorite part of the day because she knows I'm going to be there for a couple hours. So she knows she's not going to be able to go outside until I'm done.
She starts clicking away at online job boards.
I start my search log for the first quarter of 2011.
Colorado is 34. Unemployment for people like her with a college degree is the highest since 1970 at about 5%. Colorado used to work at a music company, managing and promoting bands. After being laid off, she thought about what she'd love to do and tried to pursue that.
I actually want to move into nonprofit work, specifically with animals.
She's applied for jobs in that field, also in the music industry, and in the field where she worked before music, marketing. She sent out about 200 resumes.
I've had a couple interviews. Let's see, how many have I had? 4 in 7 months.
Frustrated, Colorado started applying to jobs well below her qualifications, including administrative assistant.
That was one of the first jobs that I had out of college, so I'm finding myself back to that place, which is really difficult.
Lots of job seekers have done the same, and they're flooding the inboxes of hiring managers. Kay Sterling is a corporate recruiter in Minneapolis. Here's what her Monday morning is like.
You open up a job you posted over the weekend, and there are 500 new applications.
She has to narrow 500 down to 3 or 4 candidates. But she says that's not actually that hard to do, because she sees a lot of resumes from people like Dali Colorado, aiming below their experience level and far from their interests. Sterling says they're among the first to get cut because if she hired them...
Within 6 months, they're unhappy. They're making the rest of the department unhappy because they don't like being the gopher of the department. You know, so even if they don't leave, they just become unhappy.
She says it's a buyer's market for employers, and they'll only hire the person who exactly fits their needs.
You are better off as an applicant finding 1 or 2 jobs that you are truly qualified for and spending all of your time and energy applying to those jobs.
Sterling wants to tell applicants it's not a numbers game. Applying to hundreds of jobs doesn't improve your chances of getting one. Job counselor JT O'Donnell agrees.
That's by far the most popular method right now, and it's failing 99% of the population.
O'Donnell runs a website called Career Realism. She says blanket applying is popular because it's something for unemployed people to do with all that time on their hands. But, she says, instead of constant clicking, they need to take a deep breath and a new approach.
You are a business of one. We have to know how to market our businesses of one. You need to have special skills. You need to define your potential and brand that. And that goes completely in the face of what people think.
Pursue jobs like they're your personal clients, she says. Identify companies you admire and figure out what they need. Take classes and workshops. Because the big picture goal should still be to find work that suits you, she says. That's better for job seekers and employers.
That's when people are most satisfied, they're most happy, they do their best work, they're their best people.
When I tell all this to our job seeker, Dali Colorado, she says she doesn't feel like she can stop applying to lots of jobs. She says that would feel like she wasn't trying hard enough. But she is thinking about retraining in a field she's seen popping up a lot online.
When I've been looking specifically in the animal nonprofit sector, that there's a lot of positions open for vet tech, a lot of them.
So she set up an appointment with her dog's veterinarian to talk about training as a vet tech.
This might be a good time for me to go back to school, probably in the fall.
Colorado says she could see herself working part-time in retail as she prepares for school. And just thinking about that is helping her make sense of the chaos of being unemployed, because at least it's a path ahead. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace Money.
Tell us what you think is happening to the purpose-driven career. Post your thoughts on our Facebook page. iPhone is on Verizon. if your reaction to that news goes something like this, I'm with you. And I own one. But for commentator John Moe, it's a chance to rewrite the memories of high school homecoming.
This week, Verizon announced that it will carry the iPhone on its network. Next week, my 2-year contract with AT&T expires. You know what this means. Suddenly, I'm the belle of the ball, the girl every fellow is courting at the big dance. Will I make a 2-year commitment to Verizon, Mr. Red, with his vast networks of coverage? Or I could stay with Mr. Blue, AT&T, who promises me that for all his faults, he'll be much better than Mr. Red. Oh, but Mr. Blue, can you ever really change? When I began my relationship with AT&T 2 years ago, I wanted an iPhone, end of story, because it was cool. I already had an Apple laptop, after all. I knew where the Apple stores were. I had heard complaints about AT&T's dropped calls and lousy coverage, but every relationship requires compromise. iPhone and I were happy together, mostly. AT&T's reception was lousy in some places, my house, for instance. Still, what could I do? I was in a committed relationship. Well, not anymore. Now I have choices. I don't need you, iPhone, or you, AT&T. When my contract expires, I'll be besieged by suitors. Not just Mr. Red and Mr. Blue, maybe Sprint and T-Mobile, Mr. Yellow and Mr. Purple, promising better coverage, fewer dropped calls, faster speeds, unlimited data plans. Verizon says I could even use my iPhone as a Wi-Fi hub. Oh, my. I could take up with an Android. They have apps, you can watch video on them, play games. I think a few of them might turn into jetpacks or make me lunch. I'm not really certain. Androids are available from all sorts of carriers. But iPhone or Android or something else, I'll have to pick just one and commit for 2 years, shun the others, and hope my new partner doesn't take me for granted and ignore my needs.
John Moe hosts the Marketplace Tech Report, which you can find at marketplace.org. And trust me, if you're looking for a girl to dance with, he's really not all that.
I'm looking at the paperwork.
Should I have done that?
It's about my credit card.
Will this affect my credit score?
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's the time in the show where we tackle your money questions. With me this week is David Lazarus, consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Great to see you again. Happy New Year.
And to you.
When do I stop saying Happy New Year?
Pretty much around January 2nd.
Oh, okay. Well, never mind then.
Thanks.
No Happy New Year to you.
Morose New Year to you, too.
You know, you wrote this great column this week that I absolutely have to ask you about because, boy, it generated some outrage in me, which is, and I did not know this, that when you buy a round-trip ticket and you decide you only want to use half of it, you may actually have to pay more.
Exactly.
What?
This is a guy who's in Santa Monica. He bought a round-trip ticket from L.A. to Boston, basically, but then his company flew him out for what would have been the first leg of the trip. So the guy gets out to Boston, calls U.S. Airways and says, not going to need that first leg, but I'll just forfeit that. I just want to let you know I'm going to be booking. I'll be flying back as usual.
Uh-huh.
They said, if you miss one of the legs of your itinerary, you have to pay a $150 ticket change fee plus buy a new one-way fare on a peak day at hundreds of dollars more. And it really raises the interesting question, who owns an airline ticket? The person who bought it or the airline that ostensibly controls it?
And what is the answer to that?
The airline that ostensibly controls it.
No, you bought it.
Apparently, in the fine print, there is some weasel words that says, if there is any change whatsoever to your itinerary as you have arranged it, then all bets are off. So, in the case of this guy, he had to pay hundreds of dollars more to use only half of something that he already owned, which is a remarkable situation. Imagine if you buy...
It's not remarkable. It's stupid.
Well, think if you buy 2 tickets to a baseball game and you only use one,
right,
and then the team turns around and says, you're going to have to pony up some extra money for that. What? There's no other corollary for this, and yet the airlines apparently get away with it.
Well, I've done this before. I bought a round-trip ticket because it was cheaper than buying a one-way, but I've used the first leg and then not used the second.
And apparently you can get away with that. Now, in the case of this guy, where he didn't use the first, that's what was the big red flag. Now, he could have also, in theory, not have even told U.S. Airways
right,
that he wasn't doing anything, just showed up for the flight. Although he then runs the risk of having not been on the first leg,
yeah,
the airline might have given away his seat. All of that is apparently allowable. And here's what you do when you're faced with something like this. First of all, negotiate away that $150 ticket change fee. That's just unreasonable.
Was the guy able to do that?
Yes, he was able to do that. And also he was able to negotiate applying his previous round-trip flight to the new fare, even though that didn't cover the entire thing, because in theory, the airline can basically make you forfeit all of that and then buy a new one. So
it's worth a phone call.
Yeah, but in effect, he still had to pay hundreds of dollars more just to take half as much airline time from the airline.
What does the airline say is the reason behind this?
Well, first of all, the airline, in this case, U.S. Airways, declined to call me back, even though I put in no fewer than three calls. But the justification is basically, this is our contract, and the contract says you are booking a flight on a certain date at a certain time, and if you don't meet any part of that deal, all bets are off. And the bottom line is, if they can nickel and dime you, they will. What a surprise.
Sounds like a bank.
Hello.
All right. Well, with the outrage out of the way, shall we turn to some calls?
Come fly with me, right?
All right. Steve is with us from Woodstock, New York. Hey, Steve.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about what you do there in Woodstock.
Sure. I just switched 3 months ago to freelance reporting. So I'm moving into freelance journalism from a very steady consulting gig that I had for about 10 years.
Why would anyone want to do that?
So much fun to enter a shrinking field.
Uh-huh.
No, wait a minute. Before we get into the shrinking field part, what are you consulting on right now?
I was a technical writer and editor on a contract where we monitored date child welfare systems.
So, and you had a steady job, steady paycheck, health insurance.
Didn't have health insurance because I was a consultant, but had a work-at-home situation and pretty much full-time. So.
And you decided to move from that to freelance writing.
Not just freelance writing, freelance journalism. And will that journalism be for a newspaper?
More magazines. And I have been freelancing for about 6 years, you know, at night and over lunch and interviews, you know, whenever I get squeezed them in.
Can I ask how much you made from your freelance writing?
Last year, doing it very part-time, I made about $5,000.
Okay, that pregnant pause you're hearing at this end, that's me and Tess looking at each other and thinking, okay, is Steve on his meds or what?
Well, I've been planning for this for a lot of years, so I've put away about 4 years' expenses.
Okay.
And figuring that I'm going to have two pretty fallow years.
Okay. So is there a family in the picture? Do you have a spouse?
I do have a wife.
And what does she think of this plan?
She has been egging me on for years. She thinks I should have done it 3 years ago.
Okay. So. Well, so your question is what to do with this big pile of cash that you got sitting around?
Yes, it's been sitting in this money market checking account, drawing very low interest, and now my financial advisor is recommending that I take about 80% of it and move it into a margin account.
A margin account?
Yes. So the way that would work, I guess these were set up originally for stock traders.
Yeah, I mean, that's where you hear it, is that you're buying and selling stock on the margin.
Right. So the way it would work is that, you know, let's say for purposes of discussion, it's $80,000. So that I move into this margin account, I can borrow against that $80,000 up to 45%. I'm told by her has a current interest rate of about 10%. So the idea behind it is to make that money's been sitting there in her eyes not working, and at least now it would be working.
David, I would think, I mean, first of all, I will admit I've never heard of this. I certainly know about margin accounts in investing, but. Mm-hmm. For a savings account like this or a money market account, I would think that if this were a possibility for a lot of people to get a 10% interest rate on something, that everybody would be doing it.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the issue here isn't the act of career seppuku that Steve is about to commit with the whole freelance journalism thing. So I'm not going to get into that per se. But the whole margin thing, Steve, I'm with Tess. I think there might be some misunderstanding between you and your financial advisor, because a margin account traditionally, and to my knowledge, is for essentially a brokerage to loan you some money so you can buy stock from the brokerage and then you pay the brokerage back. That's how those things work. You don't borrow from a margin account at a brokerage to go buy a car or, you know, a weekend in Vegas.
Right.
That's not how it works. So if your goal is to have some amount of liquid cash that is still earning a decent return, perhaps is a money market account or a certificate of deposit, these are things that you should be looking at this point.
And they're not going to get you a huge rate of return right now, but they are going to bring you peace of mind and safety for that money.
Sure.
Exactly. But if you do have 80K, and, you know, I'm not a financial advisor, but we are looking at relative economic recovery and relative stability in the stock market, some might say that this is an opportunity to park your money in, let's say, an S&P 500 index fund or mm-hmm. something like that. Yes, it'll bring in some more risk, but by all prognostications out there, the economy is through much of the heavy lifting. And if you've got as much as 80K around and your goal is to put it to use a little bit more than you have been, well, there might be some good uses for it.
Okay, great.
Does that help you out, Steve?
It sure does. Thanks.
All right. Best of luck.
All right. Thanks.
All right. We've got another Steve. This one from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very well. Very well. And last I saw, there was a massive snowstorm in across the southern states.
Oh, yes. It's terrible. It's like being on a marble slippery floor or something.
Yeah. What's that like for you folks who have never probably seen this stuff before?
Well, it's strange. You get out there and the day after, I decided to get out in the streets because they said it was a little clear, but you better stay off. But I did it anyway. And you get these stretches where it's nothing, and all of a sudden you're in the middle of ice again. And if you stop, you're in trouble.
Well, I have to tell you, man, I love your voice and I love your accent.
Well, thank you very much.
She's just saying that because Tess has always aspired to be a Southern Belle. You know, she watches
Gone
with the Wind.
You know me.
You'll never go hungry again.
I'm such a lovely little lady.
A shrinking violet.
But like I say, the South is, especially Atlanta, you know, don't think it's just the friendliest place in the world all the time. Because
no. That's what I've heard.
I've burst my bubble right there.
Oh, Georgia Peach.
You know, it's okay. It's changed, though, because...
Unlike L.A., where people just welcome you into their homes with open arms.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
No one honks at you on the freeway.
Eye contact on the sidewalk every day.
It's nice. Yeah. I mean, you know, even the drive-by shootings are friendly.
All right. Well, hopefully we'll be nice to you today and help you out with your question.
Okay.
What do you need from us?
Well, I have like a 520 score.
Credit score?
Credit, yeah.
Oh.
Credit score. And I was wondering, how do a person even get mortgage approval, or even how can a person improve their score, especially when some things happened? You know, well, I ain't going to say it wasn't my fault, but things changed, didn't go the way I thought they would.
Yeah.
And now I have that credit rating, and it's difficult for me to get anything.
Can you be a little more specific about the misfortune?
What happened, I had a garnishment against me. I went to seek for, consumer help.
So is this some sort of credit repair company?
Yes. That's
okay.
What I mean, a credit repair company. They put all the credit cards I had together and helped me on paying one payment with that. And I thought that they would do the cash loan that I got the same way, but they wouldn't. But they didn't tell me that at first. So in the meantime, time was going by. And so it was looking like I was trying not to pay.
And did it go into collection, I assume?
Yes, it did.
All right. Tough situation. A 520 credit score, it's going to be really hard to get any kind of mortgage, particularly these days. Banks are going to look at that and pretty much run the other way. But some first steps toward helping repair his credit. It might take a while, first of all.
Yeah, Steve, first of all, what you need to keep in mind is you're not alone in this. A lot of people have had their credit scores and their credit files clobbered during the downturn. Now, for everybody playing along at home, your credit score goes up to 850. 850 is bingo. That's really good. Typically, a creditor is looking for something above 620. And if you're up north of that, you're in good shape. If you're in the 700s, you're in fine shape. And so since you're in the 500s, you're not destitute, but you are south of the Mason-Dixon line when it comes to your credit score, and you do need to get it back up above 600, and there are ways to do it. What you need to demonstrate is stability. And what that means is paying your bills, paying any outstanding liens, not missing payments, showing that you have a steady income and a desire and a willingness to pay all those bills on time. And your credit score will go up as a result of that.
Okay, well, I appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure. You know, just keep at it. You know, don't expect that there are going to be miracles right away, because it could take you a while. But keep at it, and you'll get that score up.
I sure will. I'll keep at it and do what I can now to stay in the clear of bad credit. Even worse credit.
Perfect.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call, Steve.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, and finally we have Jolie from Tacoma Park, Maryland. Hi, Jolie.
Hi there.
What do you do there in Tacoma Park?
Oh, I'm an engineer. I do reliability engineering.
What does it mean? Reliability of what?
Electronics.
Oh, okay, not like guys or anything like that. God, women are always re-engineering guys, Tess. Don't give me that look.
Yeah, we try. It never works.
It's because we're beyond salvage.
You are, indeed. So would you be able to tell me why my AT&T iPhone never really works?
It never works? I guess I could, but I don't know if you want to hear it.
She's going towards network issues. I just know she is.
What do you work with mostly?
Have you ever dropped that phone?
Nope.
If you've ever dropped a device and then picked it up and it still works, that's what we do.
Oh, okay. So what do you work with? What do you actually do day in and day out?
We take a look at circuit boards and components and solder joints, figure out ways of either making them last longer or make them cheaper and last the same length of time.
So you party for a living is what I'm hearing.
Not quite.
Not quite. You say motherboard to me and I'm thinking partay, but okay.
Oh, right.
All right. Well, tell us what we can do for you today.
Okay. So I was listening to you guys a few weeks ago. You mentioned sudden wealth syndrome.
Yeah, actually, David mentioned it when we were talking about
who wants
the
to be
lottery.
A millionaire?
Yeah.
So last year, my mom got in a pretty awful car accident, and she's doing fine now.
Yeah.
But when you spend 6 months laid up on your back, you get pretty bored, and then, you know, someone mentions, well, you know, you have a settlement coming to you. And so you start making a list of all the ways you're going to spend the money that you haven't gotten yet.
Ah.
Can we ask how big a settlement?
I think they got about $250,000.
Okay. Good chunk of change.
Yep.
You know, it's not massive. The guy who hit her wasn't drunk. He wasn't texting. He was, you know, spaced out. They got the check in early December, and it's like it's burning a hole in their pocket.
What's on the list?
They had to replace her car, but they definitely took a couple steps up on the car replacement. I saw some new jewelry when I was home for the holidays. I think they're planning a vacation on a cruise to Alaska. A new computer, I think, is on the list.
How far away are they from retirement?
I think my dad's probably 4 or 5 years from retirement, and she's more like 10.
And do you feel like they've been saving enough to be ready for that?
I would guess they're not ready for retirement. And so I asked them about this, and they said, well, we went and met with the guy at the credit union, and we're going to put some of it away. And they, you know, they tell me not to worry. And, you know, I don't think of them as savers.
So are you concerned that they just haven't made the right decisions here?
Right. And, you know, there's a part of me that's a little bit anxious about this, and I'm a worrywart. And
tell us about the tenor of that conversation that you did have with them. Was it awkward? Were they defensive? Were they open?
I've had this conversation mostly with my mom, and mm-hmm. she's like, don't worry, we're taking care of it. It's our money. Don't worry, we're going to spend some on you, too. And I was like, no, that's not what I want.
All right. Well, it sounds like it was an okay conversation, but I don't know, David, do you think it's worth another sit-down, serious conversation if she's that worried, or is this none of her business?
I'm going with the whole none of her business thing. Mm. Now, you and the listeners know that I'm pretty conservative when it comes to this stuff. And
yep.
When it came to our guy who won the money on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, I was the one who was saying put it away, and everybody else was trying to outvote me with go have some fun.
Everybody else?
Right.
You mean me?
You, mostly. But but on the other hand, I don't think we want to be kibitzing and being worrywarts on behalf of others. And you know, I got to say, Jolie, that your mom's a grown-up, your dad's a grown-up, and if they're looking at this as a last hurrah, then that's their decision. I don't think you want to press the point too hard. Now, I know that you're coming from a place of love, and I know you're trying to be financially responsible, but you can only say it once, I think. You know, at this point, you back off, and you let them kind of do their thing.
Okay.
What do you think, Jolie?
I think you've put my mind at ease a little bit more that I just have to trust them.
Yeah,
right.
And, you know, one other last thing, too, Jolie. If your mom says, what do you want? I want to buy you something. That's when you might be able to come back and say, you know what I want? I want you to put that money into a retirement account on my behalf, but for you.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Thanks for the call, Jolie.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you've got a question, let us know about it. Our voicemail is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org/money. David, fun as always.
Yeah, but I've got to get back to my lucrative career in journalism now.
At least you're not freelancing, man.
Oh, please. I've been there. Tough road to hoe.
And remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. We've gone a couple of weeks now without hearing about it being the most wonderful time of the year. So let's get right to the not-so-wonderful part of the year. January is considered the busy season for divorce attorneys. And as the economy returns somewhat to normal, the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers reports an uptick in clients wanting to end their marriages. Los Angeles family law attorney Kelly Chang is here to talk money, marriage, and the dissolution thereof. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
What is it about this time of year that encourages people to take that first step toward ending a marriage? Were they just hoping to get through the holidays?
Yes, there's a lot of that. And it's also the same reason you see long lines at the gym. It's New Year's resolution to be single.
So much of this is circumstantial, based on the individual lifestyle. But what does the average divorce cost?
Well, it really depends. If you hire a divorce lawyer, they're going to bill you by the hour. You can do it on your own for relatively cheap. So it really depends. It's kind of like a roof. You can do it for cheap, or you can hire a professional contractor to do it for much more.
Let's talk a little bit about how people can prepare themselves for this happening. Mm-hmm. What should each party start doing with their finances?
Generally, I see in a couple, in a relationship, somebody assumes the total responsibility, leaving the other person in the dark. So if you're the person in the dark, I would get out of the dark. Find the latest statements. They're mailed to the house, or you can call the bank. What matters if you don't have a prenup is what is acquired during the marriage, mm-hmm. and that includes credit card debt.
What do you find in terms of the cost for trying to get a settlement between yourselves versus going to court?
Much better.
Court has to be more expensive.
Everything costs money. So if it takes up too much time, it's costing too much money. So if you can reach a settlement agreement, do it on your own. It saves money.
What do you find in terms of couples being able to do that? I mean, is there a ratio of amicable to not amicable divorces?
It's interesting. I think in the past few years, I have seen a rise in more amicable behavior in the divorces. And it's probably because people can't afford to fight.
Because of the economy.
Correct.
Yeah. Because I have a divorce attorney in the studio with me, I do have to ask you about your thoughts on prenups. Mm-hmm. Based on your experience with couples going through a divorce, does it help? Does it make things easier or worse?
I think it makes things much easier.
Yeah.
I get a prenup. Marriage is grand. Divorce is 20 grand. Get a prenup. Get a prenup. I don't care if you don't have anything. You have to come in. If you have a 401k, half of that could be belonging to your spouse, whatever is accumulated during the marriage. You have to protect yourself.
Kelly Chang is a family law attorney here in Los Angeles, and we've been talking about January as a big month for, unfortunately, divorces. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tess.
So as she mentioned, a prenup is one sure way to avoid financial ruin if your marriage ends. But there's a new option to protect your money and help cover the high cost of breaking up. Perhaps appropriately, it's modeled after the financial instrument you put to work after a car accident or if your house burns down. It's insurance. Divorce insurance, to be specific, and it's the brainchild of John Logan, CEO of an outfit called Wedlock Divorce Insurance. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
This is a bit of a bummer, I must say.
How so?
Wedlock Divorce Insurance?
Well, you know, the reality is that everybody hopes that their marriage is going to be happy and forever. But unfortunately, statistics prove otherwise.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about how this works. So what's the model?
Well, the way it works is very similar to any other form of insurance in that you buy as much as you need based on what your budgets are. And the way that this works is that you buy it in units of coverage. Each unit covers you for $1,250, and each unit costs $15.99 per month. So you can buy anywhere from one unit or that $1,250 all the way up to 200 units, which is $250,000. And the way that this works is that that's the initial coverage. And once the elimination period is over, that coverage increases year over year. So the longer you're in the program, the more the value of the claim would be.
So you're paying these premiums over time, and then if you get divorced, you get a payout?
Yes.
Huh. So is that mostly a check against the possibility of having to pay spousal support and child support, or is it just merely that you'll have something to live on?
Well, it really depends on the person's situation. There was a study done at Ohio State a few years ago that showed that people on average lose 77% of their net worth after divorce.
Wow.
This helps defray the costs, whether it's legal fees or moving expenses, even therapy.
So this really is very different from a prenup.
Oh, yes. A prenup is an agreement between the two individuals about what happens if their marriage fails. It doesn't pay them anything. It just agrees on how to distribute their assets at the time of the divorce.
What has the response been? What do A, folks think about it at a dinner party, and B, how's the business?
Well, not surprisingly, people have taken, you know, both sides of the situation. And it really comes down to the individual's experience. In a lot of cases, we hear from people who have never been married or are married for a long time and probably will never get divorced. And they say, what a terrible idea. But then on the other side, there's an awful lot of people out there that were divorced at least once. And they say, sign me up.
Wow. I just don't even know how I would approach this conversation with my husband.
You know, it's one of those things that, you know, we've heard from attorneys that do a lot of prenups and stuff like that. People should do postnuptial agreements instead of something like this. And the reality is, you know, after you've been married for 5-10 years and you start to see cracks in the foundation of your marriage, mm-hmm. and, you know, like infidelity or drug abuse or anything, it comes down to the fact that, you know, people are going to say, you know, maybe my marriage won't survive. And they're going to go out and take a look at this on an individual basis.
I have to ask how and why you came up with this idea. Are you divorced?
Well, yeah. If necessity is the mother of invention, then this is the poster child.
Yeah, there you go.
What happened to me was about 10 years ago, I went through a world-class ugly divorce. And after all the dust settled, I took stock of where I was, and I was next to broke. I was about to lose my home. And I said to myself, well, gee whiz, I can't be the only person that this has ever happened to.
Hardly.
So I really looked very closely at the situation, and being the serial entrepreneur that I am, I looked at it as an opportunity rather than a problem.
Did you have a prenup first time around?
I did not.
And have you had any occasion to make use of your creation? Have you remarried?
No, I'm okay. Actually engaged, though.
Oh, well, congratulations.
So, yeah, and both of us will have a divorce insurance policy.
You will. And
yes.
And what does your fiance think of that?
This is her third time around, so okay. She's all for it.
Experience teaches.
This is true.
John Logan is the CEO and co-founder of Wedlock Divorce Insurance. Thanks so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
So are you horrified, intrigued? Tell us what you think about divorce insurance by saying I do to our Facebook page. And now for my Oprah question of the day. When you think about money, how does it make you feel? Happy and content? Nervous and anxious? Well, of course, the amount of money you have plays a big part in that answer, but it's also about who you are as a person, especially when it comes to investing. Dr. Frank Murtha is here to put us on the couch. He's with the consulting firm MarketPsych and is one of the co-authors of a new book by the same name. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Tess. It's a pleasure to be here.
One of the first things that you talk about in the book, of course, is emotion and how there are very few things that are as emotional as money. And because of that, it's important to establish your money identity. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's probably instructive to take a good look at what the market is in order to understand why it's so important to have an identity. The market is really nothing more than the aggregate psychology, and that means emotions in most part, of the participants of the market. And it manifests itself in behavioral decisions, particularly in group decisions. In a very real way, if you take a look at what I just said and break it down, that is peer pressure.
You're saying that Wall Street is like high school.
Oh, my goodness. It's so much like high school. It's scary. The smart money on Wall Street, the ones that set the trends, they're like the cool kids. So they start these trends, and then people see the cool kids doing it, so they join in. The problem is, usually the cool kids know when to get out, and the rest of us, and I include myself, are still there when it's uncool, and that's why we're there after the peak. So
that's why we're dorks.
I prefer the term geek, but a dork if you must. You know, the way that we overcome the market peer pressure is to develop a stronger sense of who we are. It's the same reason why, if you look back on your life, you are, in all likelihood, a much better decision maker today than you were when you were 17 years old.
Well, let's talk about how you figure out what your investor identity is.
Introspection.
Put yourself on the couch.
Something like that. There's a lot of different elements to what amounts to our investing identity. The most underrated and the most underappreciated are the underlying assumptions we have about why we're investing our money.
Meaning what?
Well, I think if you boil it down, most people probably invest their money from a perspective of, I'm doing this in order to someday get rich. And there's some usefulness in that, but it's much more useful to think of it in terms of, what do I want my life to look like? What is most important to me? And how can I invest to meet those goals, rather than just simply amass a lot more of this amorphous concept of money?
But no matter what your motivation is, whether it's because you want to get rich or because you simply want to have enough money that you can retire someday or you can send your kid to college, you are still out to make money.
Very true. I still would say that it is very useful to think of money as being a means to an end, but never the end in and of itself.
But what does that shift do for you as an investor? How does it make you smarter?
I'm not sure if it actually makes you smarter, but it definitely makes it a lot easier to rise above the noise of the market, that peer pressure, if you will, by saying, you know what, I'm not going to get caught up in the fear or the greed. I'm going to focus on where I am long term. And it avoids a lot of the traps that it sets us up for, because we're focusing on something that's really a means to an end, not the end in and of itself.
Well, and that really gets us to one of the key things that we always talk about here on the show and that you talk about in the book, which is figuring out how much risk you're willing to take. But you say in the book that the normal test for risk assessment is basically worthless. What is that normal test, and why is it worthless?
Do I use the word worthless? I don't want to come quite up to that. I would say that it is a very overrated concept, and it's often misapplied. A lot of folks listening to this have probably taken some sort of risk preference, risk tolerance questionnaire. There's often a bias that runs through them, which seems to say to the person filling it out, what is the maximum amount of pain you can deal with? Which is, I suppose it's a fair question.
How much cattle prodding can you tolerate?
Yeah. Say when it hurts. I mean, I say this in the book, and I'm not the first person to come up with this analogy, but it's like the dentist analogy. Imagine if you went to a dentist, and the dentist said, we want to use the least amount of Novocaine possible. All right? So you tell me what you think the most pain you can take is, and we'll go from there.
Well, then help us out with a better way, because as you said, if you're trying to predict the future, you can't. So what are you supposed to do with that?
Well, you know, I'd like to start by saying I think that when you work with another individual, it helps tremendously. I place a lot of stock in the work that professional financial advisors do. You don't actually have to work with one. You can work with any individual who can be a sounding board. Take a look at how you have reacted to scary circumstances in the past. There are lessons to be learned if one is willing to take a look at how they reacted, what their mindset was, and what they could do differently next time.
Frank Murtha is the co-author with Richard Peterson of Market Psych, How to Manage Fear and Build Your Investor Identity. Thanks so much for chatting with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Remember way back, say a couple of years ago, the days when mortgages were cheap, open houses were mobbed, and real estate was a guaranteed moneymaker?
The smartest people on the planet were telling us that it only is ever going to go up again. So it wasn't important what you paid, it was important to get in. Because whatever you paid today was going to be about 30% more in a year.
Yeah, we all know how that ended. But why? Marketplace found some answers in a report with public television station KCET here in Los Angeles. It's the story of one home in the American economy and what it says about our financial future. You can find the tale of Lot 354 at marketplace.org. What if I walked up to you and said, show me your wallet. We want to see what's in it. And why? Well, that is what we are doing every week in random places across the country. And in fact, this week, we left the country.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pockets.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Peter Keating. I'm just outside the Café de la Villa in Montreal, Canada. It's a brown leather wallet. I think it says genuine calf. I never keep money in my wallet. I always keep money in my pants pocket. I have some bills that I'm saving. I have my Gail Simon. She's my notary. Eddie Bauer. I have an Eddie Bauer card. The problem with this is there's no Eddie Bauer in Montreal, so I don't know why I have this. And I have my license with my picture on it. I'm getting old. It's one of those billfolds, standard size, with a couple of slots for my many, many credit cards. Well, my one credit card. I found it in the street. True. I did. I found it in the street. And then I just patched it up here with some masking tape to hold it together. And it's a perfectly good wallet. And oddly enough, it's the wallet I've had for the longest time. That's one side of the wallet. Then it just gets better and better. This is my healthcare card. This gives me free health. Nobody pays for health in Canada. Well, that's not true. We pay taxes in Canada that pays for our health. And I have private insurance, which I've never actually used. And I don't know what it's for. I'm able to figure out what you can actually do with it. The oldest thing is a picture of a friend's daughter, who is now, yes, it's getting a little greasy here. And it's a lovely picture, as you can see. She's there with her older sister. That's been there for... Oh, hold on. Gosh. Somebody's phone number. There's my banking password. I've been looking for that for years. I'm not kidding. It's unbelievable. It was hidden in behind the picture.
Our thanks to Judith Ritter for getting that wallet opened for us. And you can do more wallet peeping at marketplace.org/money and tell us your wallet stories on our Facebook page. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Do join us on Facebook for sneak peeks all week long of stories we're working on. We want your thoughts about them, too. And follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, think you can't wait to retire? Think about this.
It's actually pretty daunting to fill up that time. Well, not to fill it up, but to get it right. To get it so that you feel like you're intellectually stimulated and not just doing stuff.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments. You can learn about Putnam's college savings plan, Putnam 529 for America, from your financial advisor or on the web at putnam.com/529.
American Public Media.